Many decades ago, George Bush Sr. was in Red Square, Moscow, representing the United States at the funeral of the Soviet leader, Leonid Brezhnev. During that ceremony, he witnessed a remarkable silent protest by Brezhnev's widow. She was standing motionless beside the open coffin right up to the moment when the lid was closed. And just as the soldiers moved in to lower the lid and seal the casket, she performed an act of great courage and hope. She reached down and traced the sign of the cross on her husband's chest. There in Red Square, that bastion of secular atheistic power, she made the sign of the cross. The wife of the man who'd run that regime hoped that her husband had been wrong. She hoped, believed in another life, a kingdom beyond, greater than the triumphs of the Soviet Empire. She hoped that the life offered by Jesus, who died on the cross and rose again, could be the ultimate truth. She hoped in love that that same Jesus might yet have mercy on her husband. Ronald Reagan at the time was fond of calling the Soviet Union the evil empire. Perhaps looking back, we find that perspective a little simplistic and naive. But nevertheless, I think it's true that nations and cultures and leaders can rebel from God. States and societies can deny Christ and choose values and patterns of thinking, believing and behaving that are far from God's ways and plans for truth, justice, and peace. Paul, writing to the Thessalonians in our epistle, thinks the same. He thinks this is going on in the Roman Empire of his day. And so there's a strife and a struggle to be endured by God's people before Jesus returns. This strife and struggle will be experienced as rebellion and lawlessness multiply in society. And the form that that rebellion was taking at the time was through the self-idolatry of the Roman emperor, Gaius Caligula. He had declared himself to be God. He had commanded that his subjects worship him. And as referenced in our epistle this morning, he had ordered a statue of himself to be set up in the Jerusalem temple. Gaius Caligula wanted to usurp the devotion that's due to the Lord alone. And it was only his sudden murder that brought an end to his blasphemous ambitions. Now, Caligula's self-divination is quite extreme. But if you think about it, it begins to make sense within the pagan mindset. Paganism doesn't offer security in life. Your future is a shadowy existence in Hades, and during this life, your present is in the hands of some fickle or nasty god who seems to enjoy dishing out random fates to humans to toy with. Paganism breeds uncertainty, insecurity, and anxiety. But if you can grab some power, wealth, and fame along the way, it may appear to bring you security, at least for a time. And if you can gain control over other people's lives through status, political authority, or military might, then you might well feel a bit more secure too. And claiming to be God, if you can get others to believe it, puts you at the very top of the tree. Who would dare to challenge or contradict you about anything, as long as you can get the illusion to last? There was, though, one group of people in the Roman Empire who could never have truck with any such ideas. The Jews. To the Romans, that awkward, irritating, ancient sect with their odd notions, who seemed to be able to endure opposition and persecution that they routinely received. The Jews who always seemed to find ways to resist the empires under which they so frequently lived. In the first century Roman Empire, the Jews had a very different way of looking at the world than many of them around. They worshipped Yahweh, the Lord, the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. They thought he was a sovereign unimaginably greater than the emperor. They believed his kingdom had a power that totally dwarfed that of Rome. This was God, the true God, their God, who had the power to raise the dead to life and the power to bring every human thought and deed to judgment and justice. With the Lord, there's no shrinking away to the obscurity of Hades. And there's no idea that you can exalt yourself to the heights of heaven through your own personal brilliance, as the emperors fondly imagined. No, life, all life, this life and the new life of resurrection, they come as God's gift. And his gift seems to come with an assessment attached. The claim that every human, however poor or lowly, however great or imperial, must one day render an account of their life to God. Thus was the Jewish belief a radical challenge to the values of empire. Well, I say the Jewish belief, and it was something the Pharisees and Zealots, the Essenes by the Dead Sea, and the disciples of John the Baptist and Jesus had in common. But you know that there's one group that disagreed, because you heard about the Sadducees, whom we met in our gospel today. They were the aristocratic antiquarians, the traditionalists, the conservatives. They didn't believe this radical, controversial doctrine of resurrection. And this was for partly theological and partly political reasons. Theologically, they only respected the books of Moses, the first five books in the Holy Hebrew Scriptures. And they couldn't find anything explicit about resurrection in those first five books. They didn't reference Job or the prophets or other passages that the Pharisees, for example, used to ground their faith in resurrection. And politically, the Sadducees valued the status quo. It suited them. Resurrection gave hope to the masses, to the poor. It gave them dreams of a coming kingdom of God when everything would be made just. Resurrection gave people visions of change to pray for, ask for, work for, maybe even fight for. And to the Sadducees, this was rather dangerous. How much better, they reckoned, it would be for everyone to abandon this nonsense of rising again and just get on with living in the world the way it is. So when the Sadducees hear that Jesus is one of those teachers preaching resurrection, they rubbish him with a story. This tale of the woman who outlives seven husbands, because they want to make the resurrection look ridiculous. How can she have seven husbands in the next life? Makes no sense. How will she choose which one of the seven she will have as her husband? It's silly. But Jesus answers by explaining that resurrection life is different. It's not just this life brought back in identical form. It's not just the way of being that we enjoy day by day, going on forever and ever. It's life transformed, transfigured, transmuted. And he says that the relationships of our earthly life, the relationships that see us from the cradle to the grave, will not be the same in the resurrection life. Eternal existence will be different. And so he says something, and we heard it in that passage, that can be hard to hear. Something that Leonid Brezhnev's widow might have found particularly hard to think of as she made that sign of the cross. Jesus says that the resurrection has no marriage. For marriage is earthly. One thing that marriage is about is support and protection. The help that we need to negotiate the journey of life with all its ups and downs. We won't need that in heaven because we will have arrived. Marriage is a place for exclusive intimacies and joys that need to be held private, restricted in earthly living. Because they're so potent that they would destroy family, society, culture if they were wantonly shared. But when we're fully and utterly transparent to God and to each other in heaven, privacy and exclusivity will vanish. One thing that marriage is about is for the procreation of children. The raising up through history of generation after generation to tend the earth and know and serve God. There won't be children being born in heaven. Resurrection life doesn't need procreation. So marriage doesn't serve a purpose there. Marriage is a gift of God in creation. A school for love during our passageway through this earthly existence. It's one of the places on earth where we can learn a love that's a bit like the love of God. Love that's full of patience and hope. Love that's filled with wonder and joy and delight. Love that's a school sometimes for forgiveness, forbearance, and sacrifice. The love that marriage can foster is that kind of heavenly love that will endure. But as the life of resurrection is a different kind of life, that love will be shared in a new way. That's what Jesus teaches, but why believe it? Why take it seriously? Why try to let it shape your life? Well, no reason other than that Jesus rose again. No reason other than that God did in Jesus what Jesus says will happen to everyone who lives in him. And if that's so, then Jesus' life is really life. Jesus' words are really truth. Jesus' deeds are our pattern for godly living. That's what Paul exhorts the Thessalonians as they wait for resurrection. As like us, they live out their lives in the in-between time. The time in between the start of the resurrection with Jesus and its completion when he returns and all are raised. These in-between times can be hard and challenging, with empires rising and falling, sometimes bringing blessing, sometimes bringing terror. These in-between times can be hard and challenging, with rulers rising up and falling down as the years go by, some of them becoming deceivers, demagogues, claiming to be demigods. Rulers who puff themselves up and seduce and manipulate all the folk they can. On Remembrance Sunday, we recall just what damage they can do. But while this is happening, says Paul, stand firm, hold fast, grasp the truth you've been given and live by it. I wonder what that says to you. What's the message you know you must hold fast to in the journey of your life? What are the truth and values in which you know you must stand firm? Grasp the belief and hope, says Paul, that Easter has exploded into the world. Live life a bit like Mrs. Brezhnev, cherishing Jesus and his promises, even in the darkest times. Give yourself, says Paul, to every good work and every good word. While politics ebbs and flows, while wars come and go. Keep on giving yourself to every good work and every good word. Who could you say a good word to today? A word of love and encouragement, of hope or comfort? Where on this Sunday or this coming week could God be doing one of his good works through your life? Stand firm, hold fast. For our lives and deeds are valuable enough to be worth judging. Our lives and deeds are precious enough to be worth saving, forgiving, and redeeming. So that God can call us to become like the angels on that day when we share his life, the life of the world to come.